and could be worked upon. Yes, that's what they always said, and of course there's a little in that, but not very much.
But his main, well, another point was that Sirleys lacked independence of character, these are his words. And in a crisis they were not cool-headed. And I heard Mr. Ferguson, a policeman, say something very similar.
Well, they all said it. Mm-hmm. It was one of the reasons for not giving them responsibility. But again, I just think it's nonsense.
Do you think it's a rationalisation for their prejudice?
Partly that. And partly that if you don't give people responsibility, they're not responsible.
Mm-hmm. It's like pushing... Well, argument, well, if you maintain this argument, they would never have been able to get self-government.
No.
But Bose's principal argument, and again I think it has a grain of truth, at least in theory, was that, allied to your point, you see, he said that the Oriental man, mind, never trusts another, is such that they never trust another Oriental.
I think that's absurd. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that if you have a system such as existed in Ceylon and over a great deal of the East, in which nobody is so supposed to be responsible, except someone right up at the top who has to give orders, naturally mm-hmm. people aren't responsible, and then they don't trust one another.
Mm-hmm. No, but the incident you referred to earlier about Sinhalese referring to my father, that does show some prejudice in the part of the ruled towards coloured personnel being on top of them.
But you see, it doesn't mean anything. If you go around the corner, you'll find people who've got a prejudice against Jews.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if you turn another corner, you will find people, Jews, who've got a prejudice against Christians.
Yes,
saying exactly the same about Christians. Jews say, well, the Sinhalese whom I talked to had never seen what he called a hupshe. Isn't that what they call them?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The Sinhalese talked of a hupshe as a Negro, wasn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Yes.
He didn't know anything about them, but he had a prejudice against them of the same sort which the person has against the Jew, or the Christian has against, the Jew has against the Christian, perfectly irrational.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't want his district governed by him, and the next man didn't want it governed by a Tamil.
Mm-hmm. Turning to some political matters, did you ever come across any theosophists in Ceylon? Theosophists?
No, I don't think I ever did.
And what about the temperance movement, this Buddhist revival and part of it, the temperance movement?
That hardly existed in my time.
Mm-hmm. Because, of course, this temperance movement had some connection with the 1915 riots, or so the government believed, and they arrested some of the leaders.
I think it was beginning, the campaign against alcohol was beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Towards the end of my time, but I never came across it.
Did you feel that the politicians the Sinhalese politicians had a rather exaggerated sense of self-importance?
No, I don't think I did.
Mm-hmm.
I came across very few, practically no politicians in my time.
And on the other side of the coin, did you feel that, well, I have a feeling that government, that is the centre, was extremely sensitive when it came to criticism of the British rule and of the British in general. Did you feel that that was so?
I think it probably was, but I didn't experience it in my time. It was pretty calm, you know, from that point of view. It began two or three later, much more to come up that.
Yes, of course, in India things are hot enough at this time.
And then that had an effect, I think, on Ceylon. But we didn't really think in those terms in my time.
Would you say that government and civil servants were hearing about events in India, wondered about the possible repercussions or implications in Ceylon?
It was hardly ever discussed in my...
That is significant. Yeah. It's very useful.
But then, of course, again, I lived a very solitary life in Hammond Park. I didn't really see many people.
And the impression I got from talking to other civil servants, even those who were there for 30 years, is that they felt that Ceylon in India were no comparisons in the political moment, and they were not worried by it.
No, I think that's almost, you see, the relations between the white civil servants and the Cingalese were extremely good compared to what must have been in India.
Yes. For some reason or other, Clifford never seems to have gone down well with the politicians. Was he a vain man?
Very vain. Mm-hmm. Tremendously vain. Tremendous.
And of course, I think it's fairly well known that it was Clifford rather than Macallum who wrote this dispatch on constitutional reform in 1910. And well, in effect, he denied that Ceylon was ready for the self-governing process to begin.
Yes, I'm sure they would have in that way.
This is rather strange because part of the policy in the 19th century was to develop education and create an educated elite. And now when the educated elite arose by the 20th century, they argued that they did not represent the people.
Well, that was universal, wasn't it, really? I mean, in theory, that was the whole, that was policy of colonialism, of British colonialism. You educated people to govern themselves. But the moment they began to show any sign of it, you thought it was falling and tried to stop it. It was a characteristic of the British Empire.
Yes, forgetting, of course, that the things like the Magna Carta were the work of a minority.
Yes, it was ludicrous. And I mean, after all, in the Hammondtop district, in fact, there wasn't a school.
Mm-hmm.
Until I began starting them all over the place.
One of Clifford's arguments was that the masters were quite content with British rule, and that the GAs and headmen represented the peasantry much better than the educated middle class.
Yes, that was a universal argument.
Would you comment on that?
Well, of course, they made it took jolly good care that it was true by not allowing anyone to take any part in the government except themselves. I mean, if you do that, it's true. I mean, I knew much more about the Hammondtop district than any Cingalese in the district.
Yes.
But it was because no Cingalese was ever allowed to take any part in the administration of Hammondtop. If you'd allowed them to, they'd have known just what I did.
Touché. Oh yes, about the self government. What did you think of the Gan Sabha in Hamanpeta district?
It was a pretty feeble business.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't count really at all. I mean, it did a certain amount of very, very small things, but it wasn't. It never really did much.
Why was this?
Well, I don't really know why. It was never encouraged.
Mm-hmm.
The headmen didn't really like it. I mean, they liked
monolithic things.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were primitive villages, nearly all of them, and they liked to manage it themselves. And if there was any difficulty, to refer it to the chief headman. And if that he couldn't settle it, then it used to come to the government agent.
Mm-hmm. It was very funny because Hamanpeta was such a primitive district and, not influenced by modern developments like other districts. And one thought that this would be just the sort of area where the communal and more communal aspects like the Gan Sabha would have been popular.
Well, what you see, when you come to think of it, what would it, they used to do a certain amount with the village tanks, didn't
mm-hmm.
they? And I expect they did manage that to a certain extent. But it was almost certainly under the headman that it was done, and he took jolly good care that it was done in the way that he wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
They had a certain amount of jurisdiction and could fine, couldn't they?
Yes, that's right. That is it.
For small, very small things. And they did that sort of thing, but it was all so small, and the communal life of those villages was so little. They were so poor, most of them.
In other words, you feel that their scope was too limited.
Yes.
I think someone else mentioned that. So they could have done with wider powers and more duties.
You see, I think the answer to all your question is, always comes back to this, that we never took the trouble to begin the education of people in self-government.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the Gan Sabha, which ought to have been the lowest rung in the ladder,
yes.
was never taken seriously from that point of view.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't it also boil down to a question of finance? You needed money for doing all this sort of thing.
Not very much, not enough to make it that they would be, no.
Mm-hmm. For instance, even, well, education being a thing on, they were keen on, did you have enough money to undertake these village tank repairs on your own?
The village roads, of which there were Gan Sabha roads, they were maintained really by that road tax.
Yes.
The people were supposed to work on the roads and keep the village roads clear. And the Gan Sabha did do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't think Gan Sabha ever meant really to do that. I imagine what happened was that they called them out. The headmen called them out and they did the road, they cleared the road.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing was done with the tank. But in the Hamanpeta district, the tank fell into such disrepair,
mm-hmm.
partly because you only about got water in them once in about 4 years,
mm-hmm.
and therefore it really, the villagers lost heart. And it was only if you were an active GM, went round the district and said, why is this tank in repair, and called the headman, and told him, next time I come here it must be in repair. Well, then he called out the people who owned the paddy fields under the tank,
And I suppose he may have. It's so long ago. I never saw Jan Subawa's act myself. Mm-hmm.
Apart from village labor, sometimes weren't sluices called for, and that for that you needed money. You know, sluices for the tanks.
For the village tanks?
Yes. It would have been useful in some cases.
It may have been. I can't remember that. I remember there was in the East Giro part of it.
Mm-hmm.
It comes back to me that there was a large for village irrigation work, which there wasn't a big irrigation work, but there was a channel which fed various tanks. Mm-hmm. And I can remember that that was done with money. And what that came from, I don't remember. Mm-hmm. But I know that the irrigation department, who didn't as a rule deal with village tanks, I'm almost certain that they were impressed into doing it, and that we had sluices and things then.
What was the liaison like with this department? Did you find it difficult to get on with this irrigation?
It was depended a good deal on one's personal relations. I always got on very well with the irrigation people in my district. I never had any difficulty at all. I knew them very well, and we always got on very well.
Did they have the institution called Velvidanes in Hambantota?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
They were the people on big irrigation works who had to take the orders to open. And there was friction between them sometimes and the irrigation department,
mm-hmm.
because they only took the water off after the irrigation department had opened the sluice, the bigger sluice,
mm-hmm.
and they were in charge, my recollection of it, going into the individual channels,
mm-hmm.
to the individual people.
What about the size of these gansaba? Did you feel that they were too big to know the area intimately? Or were they too small?
It's so long ago that that question I'm not sure of. I imagine that they were quite small.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I see.
My recollection of Hammond's office, they were very small.
When one looks at all these administrative problems in the field, what really strikes everyone is that so much depended, well, apart from depending on the AGA, so much depended on the headman.
Enormously, yes. Mm-hmm.
What did you think of this institution and system?
Well, the truth was then, one didn't think very much about it because it was so universal, mm-hmm. that one accepted it.
Yes, I see, yes.
Universal and also the age-old method which mm-hmm. government in those districts. You see, the government of Hambantot was a very different thing from the government of a populous and very well-to-do Kandyan village.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember very much about that. That seemed to me to depend almost entirely upon headmen, who were, of course, much more sophisticated than the Low Country Hambantot headman, who was simply a very ignorant villager very often.
Yes.
And the Gansabala in the Kandyan district, I think, probably did quite a lot of work, but I can't remember that sufficiently well.
What about corruption, which is a charge which is so often levelled at headman?
Well, I have very strong views about that, and I had, when I was in Ceylon, nearly every civil servant disagreed with me.
Mm-hmm. What are your views?
My view is that there are two forms of corruption.
the English form and the Eastern form,
mm-hmm.
which are entirely different. I mean, our theory was that if you were a government person, you were corrupt if you took anything of any sort or kind from anyone whom you were administrating.
Mm-hmm.
That was totally unknown to 99 out of 100 Singhalese.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the theory of the Singhalese, well, begin with the villager, was I want a license for my cart.
Mm-hmm.
I go to the village headman. The license costs so much. So many cents are given to the village headman. That is not corruption.
Mm-hmm.
If the village headman said to you, I won't give you a license unless you give me 20 cents, when the current thing was 5 cents,
mm-hmm.
then that's corruption.
Mm-hmm.
And the civil servants who said everyone is corrupt because every headman did take cents for everything,
mm-hmm.
was nonsense. That they didn't consider it corrupt, and it wasn't.
Mm-hmm. If I may say so, of the later civil servants I met, many seem to adopt your view, and I know certainly my father accepted it.
Well, it was very much, I've had violent arguments with civil servants in my time,
mm-hmm.
who said that was nonsense. And that what they always said, it's a thin edge for wedge. That if you do that, then you are corrupt. It isn't true, or wasn't true. I mean, a lot of headmen weren't corrupt at all.
Mm-hmm.
But they all took money for doing things.
Well, they were not paid much, were they?
They were paid disgracefully.
Mm-hmm. How useful were the headmen when it came to land matters? I mean, did you trust them?
One had, up to a point, I trust. One always had to be very careful, of course. I mean, what are the reasons for... I mean, whether you knew your district or not, you knew your headman. I mean, some headmen you could trust and some you really had to be very careful of.
Mm-hmm. What about questions of land policy as such? Was there ever any sort of policy coming from the centre on land matters? I was especially thinking, I'm not thinking of the Chena problem in Hammanthotta, I will come to that, but I was thinking of this policy in an area like Kandy, where there is this policy of selling land to capitalists for development. And there you find also these peasant small holdings, and there was a conflict sometimes. And did they really think about this conflict?
My recollection of that is that in Kandy, it had been gone into with some care, and there were certain areas in which it was decided that certain amount of crown land could be sold.
Mm-hmm.
That applications were made for it,
mm-hmm.
and that when you had a certain number of applications, you fixed the land sale, and they were sold by public auction.
Yes.
But the other thing was, of course, that in many districts, and to some extent in the Tangal district of Hammanthotta,
mm-hmm.
where the land settlement was going on, you waited for the land settlement to settle the village.
Mm-hmm.
And you could then say, well, now we've got the settlement, there is this bit of land which is quite a good thing to sell it if anyone wants to buy it.
Yes, I see. Would you say that, again, especially in the more populated areas, would you say that there was a tendency to try and protect these native small holdings from, protect the native peasantry from capitalists and speculators.
I don't remember that that occurred in, of course, Jaffna was so populated that there was very little land of that sort at all.
Yes, that's why I'm concentrating on Kandy.
In Kandy, there were very thickly populated villages.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember that at that time ever happening, any danger taking place of capitalist exploitation. I think that that must have taken place earlier when the tea estates were first. But you see, there was very little opening up of tea estates that I can remember in my time.
No, I was wondering about the administrator's bias, whether many would have tended to be appalled at the thought of a Sinhalese, say of a Kandyan, losing his plot of land or losing a section of his land and therefore having to do part-time work on an estate.
Well, you see, in my time, the Kandyans wouldn't work on estates.
Not even as part-time, occasional labor?
Hardly at all.
Mm-hmm.
They were very much against it. And I don't remember instances of land being alienated, people losing it in that sort of way.
Well, yes.
It may have been, but I can't remember it happening. It wasn't a burning question at all.
Mm-hmm. What about the question of peasants selling their own land? Sometimes they were very improvident and did that.
I don't even remember that happening often, or at any rate, causing any difficulties.
Can you remember this term CQP, Certificates of Quiet Possession?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And were many called for in your time?
I think a good many in Canada.
Mm-hmm. To Europeans or Kandyans?
Kandyans.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's very, I think that was a very useful thing because it gave them...
I think it was. It's a long time ago. I think it was. I don't remember it in the Hammondorf district.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever feel that in Kandy, for instance, there were a class of Sinhalese who could be termed land brokers? They specialized in blowing up dubious claims from Kandyans, you know, dubious titles, or buying, getting one Kandyan to sell to sell a plot of land to which he had only a share. And then they sold these again to planters.
I don't remember that happening.
Oh, okay. What about this land settlement work? Did you feel that it was useful?
Very useful, I thought, yes.
Mm-hmm. A later criticism of this department is that they took a considerable amount of time to settle a village for very natural reasons, but this rather hindered the AGAs in other ways. Because this village was in the hands of the LSD, the AGAs couldn't sell land or couldn't do much with regard to the village.
Well, I suppose that did happen sometimes. It didn't happen to my district.
Mm-hmm.
No one welcomed it. They were doing, I can remember them doing the Kirima district in my in Hammond.
Near the tank.
And I think there was a man called Brain.
Yes.
Who came down. They settled in these villages for weeks.
Uh-huh.
And I welcomed it because men were wrong. The thing was really settled once and for all,
mm-hmm.
and got rid of good many disputes.
Mm-hmm. Did it also reduce the problems of cattle trespass and the like?
I suppose so. I don't remember that.
Mm-hmm. but it definitely reduced land disputes.
Yes, I mean, one of the bad things that one dreaded was a really bitter land dispute, which was a very material cause of crime.
Yes, I think so. Would you describe the land settlement work in as also a sort of a large-scale partition case, in the sense that they partitioned shares or claims to partitioned undivided shares?
I don't think they did that to any great extent. I never came across that. But then I wouldn't know very much about what was done. One used to get the village sheets after they'd settled them.
And
but they certainly couldn't settle the shares in many of the plots of land in the southern province. But I mean, you had about 50 owners to a quarter of an acre of land, didn't you? You did in my time. I mean, you owned 1/25 of a coconut tree.
Yes. Well, I don't know what they did in such cases. What was the response of the villagers?
I'm not certain of the answer to that. I think you would have found, my impression is, that a lot of them would welcome it, and of course people who would, there would be people who very much were against it. Self-interest.
Did you get to know Brain? I mean, what sort of man was he?
He was he married a missionary, I remember, and he was very good in that sort of way, but rather a dull man.
Because later on he did start a new system of tenure, and he seems to have been fairly, progressive minded.
He was, I think he was a very intelligent man. He was, had been rather a good scholar at Cambridge, of some college.
Campbell, did you know W.K.H. Campbell?
No.
Mm-hmm.
He was, I think he was after my time, really.
Probably. And this, of course, this chain of question, you're given to very much of what you thought is found in the diaries there. And would you say that basically you were against this strict refusal to grant licenses?
I think my position was quite simple. Where chainers could do a great deal of harm still, I was absolutely against them. Because they do, of course, they ruin the country.
Agreed.
But in the Ham and Top district, say in Magampatu,
it was a sea of old chainers.
Where you had miles and miles of scrub jungle and tiny little villages separated by miles of jungle. And where the water supply, the rainfall, was insufficient in 3 years out of four to make it possible for the village tank to grow rice, then it was simply imbecile to refuse to set chainers. There was only one alternative. You either ought to have taken the village away and moved it bodily to some other part of the country where they could make a living, or you had to allow them chainers. If you didn't, they took chainers without being murdered or gradually died out from some disease.
And that was what government was trying to do, was it? The orders, at least.
Government made this perfectly strict rule that in theory you weren't to allow chainers, Mm-hmm. But they knew that really, in these sort of places, land was illegal in China if you didn't grant it.
Mm-hmm.
And they never faced, it honestly.
Mm-hmm. For what reasons that did they have this strict rule? I mean,
They had the strict rule for the simple reason that acres or square miles of Ceylon had been ruined, particularly in the hills.
Yes, but it should have been obvious to them that it was a sort of different story in this dry zone where it was not commercially valuable.
Yes, but of course, part of the reason why the dry zone was the dry zone was also that it had been China. And therefore, it was a vicious circle.
Yes.
And it had gone on for hundreds of years, and the government really had never faced the problem as a whole all through the island. I don't know whether they ever have. Would you like a cup of tea?
Yes, please. Could I help you to make it?
No, I'll just put the kettle on, and then I'll tell you when it's ready.
How did you get on with the planters when you were there?
Quite well. I didn't very much like them on the whole. Some of them were nice. One had to be careful with them. They were prejudiced against civil servants.
Would you say that civil servants were prejudiced against them?
Slightly, yes. Also.
Well, I know some planters myself, and I've seen their life, and I know that they're very hospitable, and that can, well, that need not be discounted. But I was wondering whether, just because they were so important for the economy, they felt that they were, they were lords of the earth.
They didn't, because they knew that we didn't think they were at all.
Oh, I see.
But I expect in some ways they did. I stayed with them in the Badilla district when I went there to recruit after having typhoid.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to know some of them and stayed on the estate. And I knew some very sort of chairman of the Planters Association in Kandy, very, very gentlemanly, English gentlemen, that sort of place, which they were in those days, very proper. And
from what sort of class did the majority of planters come? I mean, were they...
Well, there were a rowdy, drinking set, whom we disliked, we kept them out of Kandy Club, as a matter of fact. But then there were also quite a lot of very, very respectable, rather upper class country gentlemen,
mm-hmm.
still going on now, whom you met.
Were they ultra respectable?
Very much so, yes. Very, very respectable. And regular country gentlemen who made their bungalows into sort of country houses,
mm-hmm.
and their wives and daughters were typical of English country house society.
Did you feel that these planters knew much about the life of the people, the Kandyans?
They knew nothing except about their coolies,
mm-hmm.
whom they took a great interest in, as a rule, but treated in the most paternal way. I don't think they knew anything about anything else. Some of them, of course, were the great sportsmen who mm-hmm. used to come down and shoot in the Low Country. And some of them hunted.
Did you feel that the Kandyans were greatly indebted
the peasantry. I mean, this credit system was terrible, wasn't it?
Yes, it was very bad, but it wasn't anything like as bad as it was in the Low Country.
It was in the Low Country, was it?
I think so. I think in the Ham and Top district, in the impoverished part, it was much worse. Because there you had people who, in order to get grain to sow, mortgaged their whole farming crop. Whereas I think that most of the Sinhalese in the Kandyan district villages were comparatively well off.
Was this due to better roads and marketing facilities and also the presence of the estates?
I think it was partly that if you had a small garden with a few coconut trees and a small piece of paddy land, you had enough rain to give you at any rate the beginning of a living throughout the year. And if you were careful, you were never on the verge of starvation. But if you live in a place where you don't get any rain and have to depend on rain, you're always on the verge of not of being badly off, but really on the verge of starvation.
I always wondered why the government, and why, I mean really the centre, didn't think up some sort of scheme of rural credit. Well, they did in the 1920s.
They did. And of course, they ought to have done much more in that way than they did. It ought to have been started a long way before. But you see, even in India, I don't know if you know the books of Darling.
No.
Sir Malcolm Darling. He did the rural cooperative business in the Punjab. And really revolutionized Punjab. But even he, you see, his doesn't begin until a good deal later than my time in Ceylon.
Yes, I see. Yes, well, I suppose it's the 19th century laissez-faire attitude.
Yes.
Did you feel that the British rule brought law rather than justice?
I think there was a good deal of justice.
Yeah, well, yes, I think this question...
I mean, I think it's British law is based on a certain amount of fairness, and that on the whole, where the people's interests are not concerned, it's administered fairly. Every now and again something disgraceful is done in an unfair way.
But wasn't it rather too formalized for the people, for the peasantry?
I don't think it was. I can only speak for the Ham and Top district, where it was so informal.